Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with April Smith. April is the new fundraiser for the Methuselah Mouse Project, and she's an advocate of calorie restriction, which we'll be talking about, and very interestingly has a history with labor organizing, in particular organizing nurses. She's the former organizer for the Pennsylvania Association of Staff Nurses and Allied Professionals, so bringing that labor background to the transhumanist cause. Welcome, April.
Hi, thank you so much.
Well, it was such a delight for you to call the other night about trying to get some funds for the Methuselah Mouse Project. Are you having success with that?
I am. It's going really well so far. I think people are very serious about making reversing aging a cause that is well known and showing that they put their money where their mouth is.
It's very interesting how you got involved in this, because you took up with this very difficult dietary regime of calorie restriction, and you said that you got very obsessively involved with the list. So how did you first run across calorie restriction? Did you have some dire health problem that you thought that this would help?
I didn't have a dire health problem. I was nearing 30. I was 29, and I was beginning to see the first signs of aging and beginning to feel not as good as I had when I was younger. And I reached back into my memory and remembered a book that I had read by Ray Kurzweil, a book called The 10% Solution for a Healthy Life. I don't know if anyone out there has read that, published in about 1994. And the very end of that book, Ray had mentioned calorie restriction and that it was the only proven method for extending lifespans in mammals and slowing the aging process. And I'd read it when I was about 22 and made a mental note, well, when I get close to 30, I might need to revisit this. So I decided to revisit it and did a little Google search on calorie restriction and came up with the CR Society, which is at www.calorierestriction.org, and from thence plugged into the list and read books by Dr. Roy Walford, and that was how I first became aware of the broader concepts in extension of healthy lifespans that I've gotten so involved with since.
Was it a difficult transition? It seems like such a difficult diet.
For me, it was not that difficult. I first began by just lowering my calories some and slightly changing what I ate. You know, I cut out the margaritas and nachos and switched to only red wine and cut out most sort of breads and grains and things like that. And then as I got more interested in the science behind calorie restriction and the science behind, you know, what causes aging, I began to change my diet in other ways and to lower my calories even more. But even now, of CR practitioners, I have probably one of the more flexible kinds of CR practice. I don't spend a lot of time cooking. I do eat out. I travel a great deal, and I keep it pretty low key. I eat a lot of egg white omelets and cottage cheese and a whole lot of vegetables.
So, do you put everything into software and that measures your calories on a daily basis?
I do. I use Dr. Walford's Interactive Diet Planner, which is available on Walford.com's website. I find that really helpful. I don't do it every day because there are a lot of days when I'm on the road, but it does keep a general idea, and it pointed out to me what I needed to be doing in the way of supplementation too. It's been really helpful.
Did you lose a lot of weight?
I did. I went from 137 pounds to 102.
Wow. Well, I was on Atkins last year and wasn't able to maintain that for very long. So maybe this is the next thing I have to do. Especially since I'm in this milieu, I'm always being encouraged by various people to adopt this diet, but I don't have the discipline for it quite yet.
Yeah, it's not for everyone, but I find that especially at the level where I practice it, where I do go out to eat, I do, you know, enjoy meals with friends and family, that it's really not that hard. So for me, it's worth it.
Okay, so from there you began to find out about the other avenues of life extension research that are being pursued. And of course, as soon as you do some reading in this, you find Aubrey de Grey's name. So tell us about how that connection was made.
Absolutely. Some of the most exciting moments of late night reading I've ever had. As I searched the CR Society archives looking for more information, you know, on how best to cook an egg white, I tripped across references to Dr. DeGray's work. And his work is so accessible on the web. You know, you do a 2-second search on Aubrey DeGray and you come up with tons of information about the SENS approach, strategies for engineering negligible senescence, say that 10 times fast, and you come up with a lot of information that Dr. DeGray spells out in a way that I found extremely accessible to the non-specialist. I don't have a science background. As you said, my background is in organizing and moving people, you know, not messing with cells. So I started to get very excited about that, and I think the thing that I found most personally compelling about DeGray's work is that he points out that radical advances in life-altering, life-extending biomedicine are possible, but the thing that is standing in the way of those advances taking place is the belief among large sectors of the biogerontological community and also the public at large and the funding sources that it's not possible. You know, a belief that we're talking science fiction, so let's not put money into it, let's not put effort into it, you know, let's do these other things with our money. And from my background as a labor organizer, I knew that the way I looked at the world was seeing that there are ways that people can take control of their lives at the workplace, in that case, make really positive changes. They're scary and they're difficult, but the thing that stands in people's way is their belief that it's not possible to improve. So when I started reading Aubrey's work and seeing, you know, he's saying the same thing, but he's saying it about extending human lifespans. You know, this is a guy I could really relate to.
That's a very interesting connection that you're making, because for me as a progressive also, this has always been one of the connections in my mind that what being a progressive is about is trying to convince people that all the things about our society that they ordinarily take for granted and think aren't changeable actually are changeable if they just put their effort into it and organize. And here we're saying the same thing about changing some of the fundamental constants of the human condition, such as aging and death.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of connection there that I think the way that DeGray puts it really helped for me as someone who doesn't have a background in biology or anything like that to immediately grasp the logic of the possibilities and to think, you know, this is something it makes sense for me to not just read about, but take some action in my life to push forward.
Well, Aubrey has been getting some great press recently. And by the way, I'm speaking with April Smith. This is Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. April is a former labor organizer who's now the fundraiser for the Methuselah Mouse, say that 12 times fast, Methuselah Mouse Project, and which is being managed and headed up by Aubrey DeGray. And he's been getting some great press about this recently, a lot of coverage. And with that comes some of the backlash. I guess we could get into first what the Methuselah Mouse Project is, and then I'd like to hear some of your reflections on the backlash, because it's pretty much the same as the backlash that one gets in progressive organizing. But first, tell us about Methuselah Mouse Project.
Sure. The M Prize, it's easier to say it that way, is it's actually two prizes, structured on the X Prize and also enjoying that organization's one of their chief advisors, Peter Diamatis, as our chief advisor. The M Prize is actually two related prizes. One is for the scientific research group that can achieve the next record in single animal lifespan in a laboratory mouse. So you've got your oldest total mouse, right? And the other to achieve the greatest extension of lifespan in a mouse that's already old. That's the Rejuvenation Prize. So there are two exciting things that scientists are looking at. One is simply extending total lifespan, and the other is taking a mouse that's already old and then adding on to that mouse's lifespan. And why I find that so exciting is because I'm already alive, and I would like to benefit from technologies that could not just extend lifespan, you know, beginning earlier, but that could actually do something, you know, in a few years about those of us who are already on the planet. So the idea behind the prize structure, as behind any scientific prize, is that we don't know which specific technology or groups of technologies is going to be the right thing to achieve the goal of substantially extending human lifespans. But what we do know is that if we can encourage scientific researchers who are doing many different kinds of work to put their time and energy and resources into studying this particular problem of aging that we're concerned about, that we can take our money and take that a lot farther by encouraging many scientists with the prize rather than encouraging, you know, dumping that into only one research project that has no guarantee of success. So I give $85 a month to the Methuselah Prize, you know, which is a very significant commitment for a regular person. But I know that my $85 a month, which is a commitment that we call the 300 commitment, is going to multiply itself along with everyone else's commitment into a very large prize. We're about to hit 1 million. And hoping to get a lot beyond that in the very near future, that brings a lot of attention to this problem and encourages all different scientists to work on all different avenues of attacking it.
It's a very interesting approach because I'm a big proponent of National Institute for Health funding for anti-aging research, and there are a number of different programs the National Institute for Health that could be considered anti-aging, although they're loath to put it into that framework because of the criticisms and brickbats that that brings. But the Methuselah Mouse Project is basically saying whatever research is going on out there, corporate, private, government-funded, whatever, this is the kind of evolutionary endpoint. If you can get past this line every year, then that's a marker of success. And that kind of provides a focus at the other end as opposed to the politics over which line of basic research should be pursued, as you said.
I think so. And that's one reason why I feel very confident that this is the very best way that I can spend both my time and my personal money, that it's something that it doesn't depend on me as a non-scientist making a good guess about what project to fund. It really stimulates the debate on many levels, and I feel like I also feel like the history of prizes has proven that this is a successful model for getting the most science out of our money and pooling our efforts together. And it's also a form of collective action. That was something we were chatting about on the phone. You know, people in the science and in the community of people who want to fight aging, getting together and taking collective action so that we can multiply our efforts and the whole will be greater than the sum of the parts. I feel like that's something that the M Prize allows us a vehicle for doing.
Well, it's been very exciting that Aubrey was elected the president or chair of the International Society for Biogerontology. Is that what it was?
I'm not sure right off the top of my head, and I wouldn't want to mess it up.
Yeah. Well, he's held a conference in London last year, and you've got one coming up again, I guess, in August of this year, that is focused on SENS, the Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence, as a goal. And it's bringing together all these different biogerontologists who are willing to now come out of the closet and say that they're focusing on a goal of anti-aging.
Yes. If you had said IBAG, I would have gotten that. I'm so used to looking at the abbreviations now. But, yeah, I think that's all very exciting, and that so many people are, you know, whether they love Aubrey or hate him, he is putting forth ideas that are so challenging and so inspiring that people are forced to respond.
Well, let's talk about the hate a little bit because it's beginning to come out of the woodwork. I mean, people have poo-pooed transhumanists and life extension folks for a long time as fraud, either the victims of fraud or advocates of fraud or cuckoos or science fiction, whatever. Now, Aubrey's, you know, won some legitimacy, some scientific legitimacy for the arguments that he's laid out about the different mechanisms of aging and what paths and avenues of research might address those. And now the criticisms are becoming much more pointed in the recent technology review attack piece by Sherwin Newland on Aubrey. It was followed up by an editorial, which was even more vitriolic. I think we saw the beginnings of really a political struggle between the old paradigm, which says there's nothing that can be done about aging, and the new paradigm.
I think you're definitely correct. And I think that when I read both the Newland piece and also the editorial, I really felt the same way that I used to feel when I was first talking to workers about organizing the union, when their intensely emotional negative reaction could sometimes show you that the issue is not necessarily the issue. The personal level of the attacks on Aubrey, you know, mentioning his lifestyle, the fact that he has no children, the fact that he has a beard.
He drinks too much beer.
Right. You know, things that really have nothing whatsoever to do with the quality of his opinions on aging really made me think, Aubrey has hit a nerve. His statement that, because when he says that it may be possible through these various avenues and others to change the mechanism of aging as we know it, implicit in that is saying, what are you going to do about it? And if you can assent intellectually to the idea that we do have the power to change this tragic reality of people slipping into aging and suffering and disability and death, then you have a responsibility to act on that. And I think that's something that is bound to set off a firestorm of controversy at a level that is not just rational, it's very emotional. It's hard, you know, people react to it in an intensely emotional fashion, and he's extremely gracious at handling that. I admire that.
I recently read Nick Bostrom's essay, The Fable of the Dragon Tyrant. I don't know if you've seen that, but...
Yes, it's on our website.
Right, and it's being published in the Journal of Medical Ethics. And the basic point of that is, if you put it in a different context, in this case a kind of fable context, about here everyone takes for granted that you have to feed thousands and thousands of people to this tyrant, and why don't we come up with some way to kill the tyrant? And then all the reactions, all the denial and the hostility and the it's not natural to do it, all these reactions that come out. I think it's wonderful piece at illustrating how absurd the situation that we're in now is, and how scary it is when people finally realize that there might be some way out of it, because then they have to actually, as you say, get off the pot. You know, they have to say, if it is possible to stop aging and to save all these people from unnecessary death, we need to do something about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know it has been a powerful message for me, and I really believe that one of the functions of the M Prize is to send the message that when hundreds and hundreds and thousands of regular, ordinary people, you know, like you, like me, people who live fairly normal lives, are putting our money in pretty significant amounts into this prize, we are sending a message that we believe so strongly that it is possible to do something about aging, that we are willing to make sacrifices in our own lives to bring about the dawn of radical life-extending biomedicine. And that sends a message to the NIA. It sends a message to politicians. It certainly sends a message to the research community. But to do that, it means all of us, you know, not just waiting around for the next millionaire to give a big contribution, but really putting our money where our mouth is, and, you know, something that you and I have both decided to do. And I think it's going to be really successful.
I don't want to put you too much on the spot, because now that you're in this position, I know that you're going to be talking to all kinds of people, and the Methuselah Mouse Project doesn't have any particular policy commitments besides, you know, trying to promote life extension medicine. But I think that it's interesting to reflect on what some of the other political and economic constraints are on having a policy that promotes life extension. And I'm sure you agree with me that most of the things that we can do right now today to promote life extension around the world are pretty mundane in terms of encouraging healthy eating and clean water and good education and so forth. But we also face some cultural and political attitudes about the natural, some really conservative political and religious ideas out there that could potentially be a roadblock to us ever being allowed to experiment with these kind of technologies.
I think that's very true, and it's a very difficult issue. And it's one reason why I believe that, you know, I think of my position as fundraiser now, not even so much as fundraiser, but more as organizer, working with people to help the light go on in their consciousness, where they realize that, you know, not only is curing aging possible, but that it's a good thing. And much the same way that in other realms I've worked with people to learn that taking collective action with their coworkers can have positive effects and is something that can really improve their lives. But I do think we're going to come across a lot of, you know, we're going more and more backlash as we go along. And the best way to combat that, as with anything, is through open and honest discourse, you know, being willing to engage people's arguments in all different kinds of forums, and you know, being open to their concerns, but also helping people get information that they may not have, and working together to solve some of these problems. I certainly don't have a magic bullet, but I'm excited about engaging in that dialogue, especially with people who are not scientists, because I think some of the Some of the concepts are very hard to, are almost frightening to those of us with less scientific background. I mean, I didn't even take a biology course in college. And I hope that maybe by taking some of what I've learned and the way that I learned it, that will help me to explain to other people who also lack the science background and therefore might find the information harder to believe, more threatening, more like science fiction.
I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. We're talking today with April Smith. She's a former labor organizer turned organizer for Life Extension with the Methuselah Mouse Project. And you can read her blog at aprilcr.blogspot.com, which how did you describe it? As Bridget Jones's diary on a diet or something?
I describe it as, with much respect to Helen Fielding, Bridget Jones lives forever or dies trying.
And it does have a lot of that feel to it. It's a very pleasant blog, and I appreciate that because I try to write my own blog, and I don't get to it as often as I should. You are a woman, and there aren't very many women in this kind of activism. A lot of the tech-positive activism, and I think it's especially interesting that you used to work with nurses, because I'm sure that when you started to talk to the folks that you're working with in healthcare about what you were doing, that you got some very positive and also some quizzical reactions. But reflect on that, and also reflect on the fact of why you think women tend to be more reserved about the notions of radical changes in the human condition through technology than men tend to be.
That's a good question, and you're right. When I first started talking about it among the nurses I work with, I got a combination of, you know, go out and do that fast so that it'll happen in time for me, and, well, you know, I'm perfectly happy with just dying. And I always think, let's talk when you're 80. But in terms of why are there fewer women, one thing I was thinking about, and I just moved the blog entry up to the top so anyone who clicks on it now will read it, but in my blog when I was writing about my decision to make this transition in my life and to leave a, you know, very successful and pretty secure career to go out on a new venture, one thing that really motivated me was I feel like I hear the clock ticking, not just for me, but really for the people around me. And my decision to, you know, join the 300 and give $1,000 a year to the M Prize for 25 years, my decision to encourage others to do so, my decision to fundraise full time is not just about me living longer, but I see it in a very real way about the people around me who I care about being able to live longer and being able to be happier. And I think that women oftentimes do come at the world from a nurturing others, caring for others perspective. I know that a lot of my labor organizing was really involved in being the person with nurses, being the person who cared for the caregiver. And I see this as an extension of that because the changes, you know, whatever change I am willing to contribute to by helping with the SENS project and by pushing the M Prize further is something that, you know, not just a few people around me will benefit from, but that the whole world might be able to benefit from
What you're putting your finger on there is that there's a notion in a lot of circles that life extension is an intrinsically selfish project, that it's about individuals wanting to live longer themselves and rather than about creating a society in which we can all live longer. No one contests the fact that providing general nutrition and clean water in the world is a good idea and is not a selfish thing. And what we're talking about here is making sure that there are technologies which allow everyone to live another 50 years.
Exactly.
So how do we make that point? If that's one of the key things that are holding back support for life extension technology, not only among women, but among all kinds of people in all kinds of political and cultural circumstances, if they think it's an intrinsically selfish project, that it's going to lead to overpopulation, a destruction of the world, what kinds of additional policies or alliances need we make, do you think, in order to move beyond that?
Well, I think that's a big question. And in terms of some of the arguments against, you know, you mentioned the overpopulation concern. I remember one of the things I read talked about when people were first talking about radically decreasing infant mortality, the same concerns about overpopulation came up. Didn't occur to anyone that we would figure out birth control. Aubrey has a lot of really, really good answers to those kinds of questions on his website, and that's at www.gen.cam.ac.uk, and then /sens. And many of his arguments I found so compelling on the surface of them that I was convinced on first read. Now, in terms of, obviously, we're not going to be able to get society at large to sit down and read Aubrey de Grey's website, though it is kind of interesting to take a moment to envision a society where that was possible. But I think that reaching out as the emprise by making this statement, you know, you were talking about it's people see life extension as inherently selfish. You talk about, I got a comment on my blog the other day that said, who are the donors? You know, because I said I'd been talking to donors. What kind of people are the donors? Are they just wealthy individuals who want to live a long time? By more and more people getting involved at the grassroots level, you know, students, academics, regular people, healthcare professionals, people for whom any contribution, $10 a month, $20 a month, you know, $100 one-time contribution, any contribution like that is a sacrifice financially. More of those people get involved. More of those people get involved in educating the people in their community, you know, people who are on school boards, people who are involved in local politics. More people get involved the same way you would build any grassroots movement. That sends the signal that life extension and extending people's healthy lifespans isn't just for rich science fiction fans. It's something that a lot of real people are taking seriously. And I think when we're able to build more of a grassroots movement, and the emprise is a great vehicle for doing that, it will help us to make those arguments to places like the NIA, where we're eventually going to have to go for large amounts of funding. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I think your question is such a big one and such a difficult one that, you know, as we all sort of brainstorm, we'll come up with more and better ideas.
I think that was a very politic answer. And I also want to point people to the book, The Scientific Conquest of Death, which I think Aubrey has a chapter in. It's a collection of essays which addresses also the philosophical and some of the practical policy questions of immortalism. It's published by the Immortality Institute, which will be holding another conference next fall that people can attend. And also Ray Kurzweil's book, I'm sure you've seen, Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. It has some very controversial health recommendations in it, but at least the basic message that if we live long enough, we may be able to live a lot longer than that.
Yes. It's right here on the shelf.
Yeah. So, April, I really want to thank you for joining us today, and I hope that people do take a chance to go to the Methuselah Mouse Project website and consider making a donation there to support this really fantastic work. And it's so wonderful to meet a progressive woman involved in this activism, and I hope that you have an increasing amount of influence on getting us to think about things in a slightly different way than we have so far.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with your listeners. It's really been fun. And be sure to click on the emprise website. That's at www.emprise.org. It's one word, www.emprise.org. Thanks.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.